Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED's California Report and your moderator for today's program. Find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Today, we discuss the future of human papillomavirus prevention and controversy surrounding the current vaccine Gardasil. HPV can be deadly, and many studies have suggested that the new vaccine Gardasil can be effective in preventing most types of HPV. But controversies still surround the vaccine. Many women can't afford Gardasil because of its high cost and age requirements. Others worry about being forced to give the shot to their daughters when the long-term effectiveness is not known. We are fortunate to have with us a panel of experts from the healthcare field who will discuss the health and sociopolitical issues surrounding Gardasil and the future of HPV prevention and treatment. I'll introduce them now. I'm pleased to welcome today's panelist, Dr. Joel Pilevsky. He's an infectious disease specialist at UCSF, specializing in the development of new treatments for HPV. Dr. Dean Blumberg is an associate professor at UC Davis Children's Hospital and has served as a project consultant on the CMA's Cervical Cancer HPV Project. He was an unpaid speaker for Merck, maker of Gardasil. And our final panelist is Dr. Alina Selganikov. She is the Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation. Her work focuses on health policy issues of importance to women, with an emphasis on health coverage and access to care for underserved women. My first question is actually for Dr. Pilevsky. I wonder if just for our audience, not knowing really how much people know about HPV, I wonder if you could just describe what HPV is and what exactly it causes.
HPV is one of the most common sexually transmitted agents, thought to infect up to 80% or so of sexually active adults at some point in time. And the major health consequence is cancers in the areas where it infects, primarily cancer of the cervix, which can kill up to 250,000 women per year worldwide, as well as cancers of the anus and other areas of the genital tract. In addition, it will cause warts, which is another serious problem.
Actually, that was my question. We were talking before the program started that it's not just cervical cancer, but there's other things that can happen to you if you get HPV. I wonder if you can just describe how serious those kinds of warts might be for a woman as she gets older.
Well, warts by themselves are not deadly. However, they are associated with a lot of discomfort, psychological trauma, pain, and expense for treatment. In addition, there is a rare but also deadly condition called respiratory papillomatosis, where moms who have warts can pass the HPV to the babies as they're passing through the birth canal, and they cause obstruction in the breathing tube for the babies. Another area of emerging concern is oral cancer, because it's now appreciated that about a third of oral cancers are associated with HPV. So if you add up the totality of cervical cancer and the various other cancers known to be caused by HPV, it's a very significant public health problem.
And we tend to think that HPV is something that's passed only through, say, sexual intercourse, but that's not actually true, right? You can get it other ways.
HPV, there are many types, and they also infect the wart, cause warts on the hands and the feet. These are known to be spread through non-sexual means, walking around on a gym floor, for instance. But the genital HPV types are primarily spread through sexual transmission.
But also oral intercourse or oral sex, for
instance. Oral sex, yeah. That would be one of the many forms of sexual transmission.
Dr. Selganikov, I wonder, what have you seen so far in terms of the percentage of women and young girls who are actually getting the vaccine?
The CDC recently released a study, and I think that about 37%, I think, last year of young teens were vaccinated. When you look at who got three doses, because it's a three-dose regimen, the number is around 18%.
And what are you seeing in terms of that catch-up group, the group of women that
the catch-up group is significantly lower, and I think part of the challenge there is that when you're looking at the catch-up group, the vaccine has been recommended for girls 11 and 12, and then also for older groups up to age 26, so that we have a larger group of women that are protected against the HPV virus. But the older group doesn't have the financing mechanisms. A lot of those women are uninsured. 27% of that age group is uninsured, and a lot of private insurance. It's a little mixed in terms of the scope of their coverage, and it's expensive.
How
basically,
much does it cost?
If you're looking at out-of-pocket costs, it's around $500 mm-hmm. between the actual cost of the vaccine and then what it costs to actually go to the doctor to get the vaccine.
And are private insurers and public insurers like Medi-Cal paying for the vaccine?
Medi-Cal, for children up to age 18, actually, there is a federal program called the Vaccines for Children program, which actually pays for 40% of vaccines for children in the country. And so the Vaccines for Children program covers it for Medi-Cal and for uninsured children. The challenge is more for the groups that are in the higher income. Medi-Cal in here in California pays for it for women up to age 26. But in other states, adult vaccination is at state option, and it's pretty mixed in terms of what the states are doing, primarily because of the cost, I
believe.
And
so what are we seeing right now? If I'm 20 years old and I have a Blue Cross HMO, is my Blue Cross HMO going to cover my vaccine?
It depends. I can't speak for the Blue Cross HMO. Some of them do and some of them don't, and it really depends on your individual plan. And there's a lot of variation, and then there's also a lot of variation in terms of the out-of-pocket costs that a woman will pay even if she has coverage. You know, what is the copay? Does this go towards the deductible? And who actually ends up dispensing it? As everyone knows, our healthcare system is quite complex, and this issue really captures all the complexity that's there.
Dr. Blumberg, I wonder, what are you seeing so far in terms of the safety data now that the vaccine has been out for a couple years? Are we seeing anything different that we didn't see in some of the earlier trials?
I don't think we're seeing anything dramatically different. The safety monitoring in this country is primarily done through the FDA and the CDC and other groups, and then the vaccine manufacturer does some post-licensure safety monitoring also. But the CDC recently reported on the experience in this country on the VAERS data, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, and collected all the adverse events that had been reported to them and analyzed them. That was just reported in August, and it was after the first 20 or 23 million doses have been distributed in this country. Now, we can talk more about that. There's a lot of limitations of that data, which is that it's a passive reporting system. People have to make the report, and there's no active surveillance for those adverse events. Anybody can make a report, a doctor, a parent, a lawyer, anybody who wants to make a report can do that to the system. But obviously not every reaction is going to be reported also. Well, when they took a look at that data, there were really no signals, no surprises. There wasn't anything that wasn't seen in the pre-licensure data. There were a couple things that were reported more often than they had expected, but this can partially likely be explained because of some publicity about these events.
What are you seeing in terms of some of the more common responses to the vaccine? Some of the more common adverse effects?
Yeah, well, one of the most common adverse effects is pain and tenderness at the injection site. And this was seen in the pre-licensure studies. In fact, about 70-75% of girls who got this vaccine ended up with pain and tenderness at the injection site. And so now when girls get this vaccine, sometimes they will complain for a couple days afterwards of having a sore arm. Another one that has been known also is syncope or fainting when people get the vaccine. And I think we haven't paid a lot of attention to that in general, not only with this vaccine but other vaccines, in that we've had a recommendation that after receiving a vaccine, one should wait in the doctor's office for 15 minutes before leaving, just in case there's a fainting reaction. But I know from my own personal experience that sometimes I get a shot and then you just walk out and leave. And so if something can happen later, of course, it could be more dangerous if you're upright than if you're sitting on an exam table.
Get your lollipop and leave.
Right, exactly.
when this vaccine was first approved, we heard from some school districts, particularly Los Angeles Unified School District, had announced that they were going to offer this vaccine through their school nurses. What have we seen, maybe Dr. Blumberg, just to stick with you, what have you seen so far in terms of other schools deciding to offer this vaccine? How well has that been received?
I think that was more of an unusual case in California where L.A. decided to do that, and I can't speak for their reasons doing that. I think school vaccination is very important. There's a lot of vaccines that are important for children to receive, and if they're not going to their doctor, as adolescents sometimes don't go to their doctor on a regular basis, then the school's a great way to reach them. I know that some public health clinics have also given out the vaccine as part of health fairs or drives to make sure that that adolescents are vaccinated. And it's not just this vaccine, but this vaccine ties in with other recommendations for adolescent health in that adolescents now recommended to make a routine visit at 11 to 12 years of age and not only receive for the girls the HPV vaccine, but then two other important vaccines, the meningococcal conjugate vaccine, which prevents causes of shock and meningitis, and then the TDAP vaccine, which is a tetanus shot plus diphtheria and plus prevents whooping cough, also a whooping cough booster for adolescents. And the recommendation is for the adolescents to make this visit and make it routinely, because then that can tie into other health promotional activities. Children are at that age or just at an age where they might need education regarding dating violence, appropriate internet use, appropriate eating habits, try to prevent obesity, have physical activity, sexual education. So there's all sorts of opportunities at that 11 to 12-year-old visit to provide anticipatory guidance.
Dr. Slanikoff, did you want to add something?
Yeah, just to say that the big controversy around that was particularly immediately after the FDA approval and the recommendations that it be included as part of the teen vaccines was when there was a big push for mandates for this to be a school entry requirement. And that's where there was a tremendous amount of pushback. There was very strong lobbying of state legislators because this is a decision that's made on a state-by-state level. And so when you have that type of authority over the state, it becomes very complicated. It's not just you have a federal rule. It's each state has to make the determination. And there was a lot of effort. I think right now only Virginia and the District of Columbia require it, but it is there's been a lot of efforts in the state legislators to get it passed, and then subsequently a lot of pushback.
And then there's, of course, even if the state does mandate a vaccine, there's always these opt-out.
There's all of them always have opt-outs.
For religious reasons or moral reasons, that sort of thing.
And that exists for current vaccine, for all other vaccines as well.
Yeah, Dr.
Bloomberg. And California actually has one of the most liberal opt-out policies in the nation, mm-hmm. so that parents can opt out of any quote-unquote mandated vaccine that they want to. But I've worked with statewide immunization coalitions on mandates, and the HPV mandate was the wrong mandate at the wrong time when that was brought up in California. And when vaccines first get FDA approved and the recommendations are made for their use, consumers, patients, doctors need to feel more comfortable with it. And then after several years, 5 or 10 years, it might make sense to consider the circumstances that would lead to making a state mandate. And most of these circumstances not only relate to individual health, but how the disease is transmitted in public health also. And for this vaccine, it just didn't make any sense. The push was too soon, and I'm not sure that there ever should be a real mandate for this vaccine for public health purposes. One of the things that we were working for and failed, our coalition was working for a pertussis vaccine mandate for school, because there are outbreaks of pertussis that occur in the school, whereas HPV, the normal activity that occurs in the school, will not lead to an HPV outbreak. And so it just doesn't really make sense to tie those two together, in my opinion.
Dr. Pilevsky, I wanted to ask you, what do we see in terms of the health disparities, both for access to these vaccines for HPV, but also then for the cervical cancer itself? So are there certain racial or ethnic groups that bear a heavier burden?
Absolutely. So the health disparities are less for the vaccines, particularly the under age 18, because of the vaccines for children. That's one of the reasons that program was brought in, to make sure that everybody had equal access to the vaccine. But cervical cancer in this country is very much a disease of lower socioeconomic status. The majority of women who get cervical cancer here have gotten cancer because they have not had routine pap smear screening. So they don't go in for their regular checkups, they can't afford it, don't have access to the healthcare system. And these are the women that tend to be at highest risk for getting cervical cancer. So if we did have a way of administering the vaccine to a broader range of people, and that it would, and that the protection lasted long enough, then I think that disparity would eventually diminish.
Let me turn to a couple questions from the audience. One of the questions is, what are the positive outcomes of males receiving the Gardasil shot? Dr. Bloomberg, do you want to talk about that?
I'd like to emphasize that at the present time, the vaccine is not FDA licensed for use in males. But theoretically, the vaccine would be beneficial for males in terms of preventing genital warts, because it is a quadrivalent vaccine, and two of the types in the vaccine are the most common causes of genital warts in both males and females. And then the other outcome is the other two types are the high-risk types, the most common high-risk types that are associated with cancers. And the numbers really pale in comparison to cervical cancer, but men also do get penile cancer and scrotal cancer and anal cancer, and theoretically it might prevent, the vaccine could prevent those cancers. That's all theoretical. The company that produces the vaccine has done studies and submitted these studies to the FDA to gain licensure in males on the basis of prevention of genital warts, just because that's a lot easier, that's more common, so it's a lot easier to prove that it works to prevent warts. And the FDA recently reviewed those findings and looked upon them favorably. So it may be licensed soon for that. And yeah, I would hope that maybe it might also prevent some of those other cancers. And I don't know if maybe the vaccine might prevent some of the head and neck cancers also.
Are other countries treating this differently? Are other countries mandating not just girls but boys as well get the vaccine?
There are about 70 countries around the world where the vaccine is approved for use in both boys and girls. None where it's covered for boys the same way it is for girls. And in those countries, the use in men is somewhat limited. There are other countries, particularly those in the Middle East, where women have very limited access to medical care. And there have even been some proposals that instead of vaccinating all women, if you're going to choose a gender, it might make more sense to vaccinate all boys.
Interesting.
And everything that Dr. Blumberg said was correct about the warts. But one thing I'll add, and we were involved in the studies that looked at this, is that there was very clear evidence for efficacy or ability to prevent persistent infection with the cancer-causing types in the boys. So the wart prevention was due to type 6 and 11, which don't cause cancer, but there's good evidence to suggest that the vaccine should work in boys almost as well as in the girls.
Dr. Slinikoff, let's give this next question to you. Do you think that this vaccine should be mandatory? And if so, at what age should girls receive it?
I at this point, I think that right now we're not ready to make it mandatory because I think that our society is not ready to even accept it. So I don't think that it makes sense to do something. We don't really have the long-term data that we know that we need to make those kinds of decisions. But I do think that there is a greater need for people to have better information about what this vaccine does and what it, how it can protect women and girls. I think that the complication, too, is that most HPV infections actually cure themselves. You know, so it's a little complicated because you can have, it depends, you know, there's lots of different types of viruses with types of the HPV virus. And so there are a series of them that are associated with cancers. So we know we have a tremendous breakthrough. I mean, this is really one of the first, I guess, times where we actually have a way that we know that we can prevent a virus that we know is associated with a cancer. And so that is really, really important. But I think that we have to watch over time. This is where knowledge is power, and the more we know and the more we share and communicate it with the population, I think that that's going to make a much stronger case for later on greater acceptance.
These next two questions are related. One is, how many strains of HPV actually exist, and how effective is the vaccine against the separate strains? Dr. Pulaski, do you want to take that?
So there's over 100 different types of HPV. About 30 of them actively infect the genital tract, and of those, only about 14 are considered to be cancer-causing. The currently available vaccines, quadrivalent, made by Merck, that's Gardasil, has type 16 and 18, which are the two most common cancer-causing types. And the other vaccine that's made by GlaxoSmithKline called Cervarix has type 16 and 18 also. Between the two of them, they account for about 70% of all cervical cancers. So both companies are actually actively involved in trying to broaden the vaccines to include the other cancer-causing types, and the next version might have as many as 9 types rather than 4.
So would you imagine that Cervarix and Gardasil, are they competing against each other, or is the idea that you would actually need both?
They do not. You don't need both. In many countries, the governments have chosen one or the other, and in the United States, Gardasil is the only one that's FDA-approved, though the FDA recently did review Cervarix as well. When it becomes available, then people will have to make a choice. And then when the so-called non-avalent vaccines, the ones that have more HPV types in them, become available, my guess is that they will have the same range of types, and then it becomes a question of cost and other factors.
And Dr. Bloomberg, a question for you. I wonder if you can just talk about how quickly an initial many HPV infections have come and go, and you don't even necessarily know that you've been infected. But for those that are more serious, how quickly does that HPV infection take hold, and what is the time frame between HPV infection and developing, say, cervical cancer?
Yeah, well, I'll give a shot and then have Dr. Pilevsky clean up on this. But when HPV infection occurs, almost all those infections resolve by themselves, especially with the high-risk types. So within the first year, more than 95% of those will resolve, and there's no further bad things that happen. So that's the good news. But for the few percent that do hang around and cause persistent infection, then within a few years you can get development of the precursors for cervical cancer, the cervical intraepithelial neoplasia types 2 and 3. And then years down the line, which may be decades down the line, then that's when cervical cancer first occurs. So it's a long process. Where it starts is with the initial infection, which then becomes persistent infection. And then years, decades later is then when we're seeing the cancer. So the idea behind the vaccine is vaccinate the kids before they get infected, and then we'll prevent the bad consequences of infection. Did you want to?
You know, I think that's all very well put. The only other thing I'll add is there's controversy as to whether or not we truly clear those viruses. It is true that in 95% of cases, the DNA or the virus is no longer detectable using the standard available detection tests. But studies, particularly in immunocompromised people, including HIV-positive people, strongly suggest that once you get an HPV type, while in the majority of people it becomes clinically irrelevant, it probably hangs around in very small quantities. And if you become immunosuppressed later in life, those previously acquired HPV types could reactivate and then cause some of the same problems that you just described.
And just a reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking about the impact of the new vaccine Gardasil and what the future holds for the prevention and treatment of HPV. Our panelists are Dr. Joel Pilevsky, UCSF Infectious Disease Specialist, Dr. Dean Blumberg, Associate Director, Pediatric Infectious Disease, UC Davis Medical Center, and unpaid speaker for Merck, the maker of Gardasil, and Dr. Alina Selenikoff, Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm Sarah Varney. I guess the next question I wanted to ask was about this issue of screening and what role screening plays in conjunction with vaccination. Let's see, Alina, do you want to take that one?
Well, they're still recommending that all women get screened. The screening requirements have not changed. And, you know, over time, as we have higher and higher rates of vaccination, those recommendations may change. But right now, we're still recommending that women, all women, girls who get vaccinated are subsequently screened because it covers 70% of the strains that are associated, not all of them. And also, there are three doses, and what we're finding as well is that it's difficult to get, particularly teens, anybody to get three doses. So that is still an important issue. You know, this is one of the cases where you have a new technology that people are adopting at the same time where you still need to have an existing technology. And so the kind of the cost burdens at this point are the heaviest. Over time, we may see that change.
And maybe, Dr. Bloomberg, you could explain this. I understand that earlier this year the FDA actually approved two new HPV DNA diagnostic tests. Can you explain what those are, how those are used?
I'll defer to Dr. Pilevsky
on
that.
Dr. Pilevsky.
So those tests are similar to the one that's currently available, which is called the hybrid capture test. And it is aimed at finding the cancer-causing types in the cervical specimens. The new test is similar, uses a slightly different technology, but one of those two versions is a little different in that it targets specifically type 16 and 18. Although we've said 14 types cause cancer, in fact, type 16 and 18 being the cause of 70% of those cancers really are thought to be in a class by themselves as far as cancer risk is concerned. So rather than scare a lot of women, if it happens that one of these 14 types is not 16 or 18, if the test comes back positive. The idea is that if you focus on the really bad players, then you can more accurately target your counseling and your preventive measures to those women.
There's a question here from one member of our audience who asks whether or not you think that this emphasis on the vaccine will reduce efforts to improve gynecological care, like Pap tests and, as we just mentioned, the HPV DNA test. Alina, do you want to take that?
I mean, I think that there's a concern. We were actually talking about this earlier. I think, you know, when the home pregnancy test came out, there was actually a pushback from some family planning providers because one of the leading reasons, particularly teens, come to family planning clinics is to get a pregnancy test. And then once they're in, then they can get the appropriate counseling and information. And I think that having a Pap test is often a draw for patients, and very often for women, their OBGYN is their primary source of care. And so as you lessen reasons that women go, there's concern that fewer will come in. I think the other side to that is that there's concerns, again, as I mentioned earlier, that you feel the sense that you are protected when, in fact, you still need this.
The speaker or the listener, the audience member, I'm sorry, I'm in radio, so I was thinking of US listeners, goes on to mention that countries like the UK with a national health system have lower rates of cervical cancer mortality than the US, even before the vaccine was available. So can you speak to what this country needs to do in terms of not just getting this vaccine out there, but also improving gynecological care overall, particularly for some of these populations that we mentioned really lack access?
Well, I mean, one of the things we were talking about earlier is who gets cervical cancer. I mean, this is the burden of cervical cancer is on poor women, uninsured women, and so anything that we can do to, one, improve coverage, this is a big discussion in Washington right now, but clearly anything that we can do to promote access to care will open the door, because early detection, I mean, this is the key. We can, you know, I think, avert most of these cancers if they get the Pap smear, but again, making sure that access to care, that one, that they can afford to go, but also that they know that this is an important area.
Dr. Plasky, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think that's all correct. The problem, of course, is that the majority of the resources now are going towards vaccinating women in preventive mode, and that's terrific, but it doesn't do anything to help the women who've already become infected with those HPV types. And so the only solution, I think, until we have the majority of women vaccinated, which will take decades, I think, is to really pump up the system to allow women who need that access to get it.
And perhaps just a sort of a simple question, which is that if you've been infected with HPV and it's kind of come and gone, are you now immune to that? Or do you still need to go get the vaccine, Dr. Plasky?
Well, the data suggests that when you get HPV, it will generate antibodies to that HPV type, probably preventing you from getting the same HPV ever again, but it does nothing to prevent you from getting disease with the type you've already acquired. The thing is, with the Gardasil vaccine, there's four different types, and the suggestion also is that even if you've been infected with one of those types, if you haven't been exposed to the other three, then you'll get the benefit of vaccination for those three types.
It strikes me that there's also an analogy here with what we've seen with hepatitis B, which is, again, we also have a vaccine to prevent a cancer-causing virus, liver cancer. And one of the things we see in Hep B, which is interesting, is that while vast majorities of people who are born in the United States are now vaccinated against it, of course, we still have new immigrants coming into the country, in the case of hepatitis B, mostly from China, who are not necessarily being screened, and then they're 50 years old, and all of a sudden they have a football-sized tumor in their liver. I wonder if you can talk about a different kind of strategy that you might need to employ with new immigrants as they come into this country who are not being caught with this early vaccination program and might not even be caught in the sort of catch-up generation that you mentioned, Alina. Dr. Blumberg, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think the hepatitis B analogy is a good one, and hepatitis B was the first anti-cancer vaccine that we've had, and In terms of other countries that were even ahead of us with promoting hepatitis B vaccination for their population, such as Taiwan, which had higher incidence of hepatitis B and so a higher incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma, when they vaccinate their population against hepatitis B, they found a decreasing rate of hepatocellular carcinoma, as well as other bad outcomes from hepatitis B, such as cirrhosis, which can occur years later. So, I mean, that's a tremendous public health benefit, and it's a tremendous benefit to individuals who don't get cancer because they've been vaccinated. And now we've got HPV vaccine, which prevents cancer. And so I think it's something that we can really be excited about, that we've got a vaccine that can prevent a good portion of some cancers. And, you know, people should be really enthusiastic about getting that vaccine. With hepatitis B, in terms of in this country, it's still important for certain populations to really have outreach efforts to them. So I know in California, for example, there's very large Southeast Asian immigrant population, in the Westminster area and other areas in Southern California. And so there are those who are making big efforts to have outreach to those communities, make sure that they do get vaccinated, make sure that they do get screened and other health issues. And so I think that's important to be done. And with HPV, we know which women who are most prone to getting HPV, and we need to make the effort to make sure that they get care to prevent the bad outcomes from it.
But I guess the question would be, yeah, Nalini, you can talk about this, is if you then go on to change, if you get mass vaccinations, and then you go on to change recommendations around how often you need to do a pap smear, for instance, or other types of screening, does that miss out on certain populations then who particularly new immigrant populations?
Well, a lot of the recommendations that we have around screening services actually have different periodicity for groups that are at higher risk. So we actually don't always have the same screening recommendations. But getting back to your point around the HPV vaccine in immigrants, I mean, it's also been used to say that, you know, immigrant women need to be vaccinated. And that is a particular problem because it is, you know, these are not women who have insurance, and to, you know, come up with $500 is a real barrier. And I think that there are other ways. I mean, and given the fact that this is not something that we're likely to have a massive epidemic that is caused by the fact that, that HPV-infected women are coming and men are coming, that, you know, we really need to be thoughtful about how we implement these policies.
There's one other point that I think needs to be made with respect to cancer prevention. Although it is true that ultimately the reason to vaccinate against HPV is to prevent cancer, in this country, the cancer rates are low. Mm-hmm. The cervical cancer rates are low, which isn't to say that the vaccine isn't valuable, but I think we need to recognize what its primary value is here, and that is in the prevention of the morbidity and the procedures and the stigma associated with treatment of genital warts and high-grade cancer precursors. So it's the reduction in the treatment called loop electroexcision procedures, LEAPS, to prevent the cervical cancer that I think really provides the value for young women in this country. In the developing world, it's a whole other story. There, the cancer rates are really high. There are no preventive screening systems and treatment systems. So in those countries, it really is primarily about prevention of cervical cancer. Unfortunately, and this is a problem that really has to be addressed, these are also the countries that can least afford the vaccine. Vaccine is way too expensive to be used in those countries, and so we have to find a way of making the vaccine affordable there.
This is actually a question from an audience member as well that plays right into that, and maybe you can answer this, Lena. It says, with the greater burden of cervical cancer in the developing world, are there any plans in the WHO's Global Fund to include this as a covered vaccine?
That I can't answer, but getting back to the affordability, I mean, I think with the antiretrovirals around AIDS is a perfect example of where they said, oh, nobody can afford it. But in fact, you know, we are getting access. There are options and lower cost options, and it is saving millions of lives in the developing world for people who are HIV infected. So I think that because it's, you know, we shouldn't say we can't do it because it's very very expensive. I mean, this is the leading cause of cancer death in women in the developing world.
So what is the responsibility then of Merck, for instance, to try and do what many of the antiretroviral manufacturers have done, is to provide this either at no cost or at a subsidized cost? Dr. Plesky?
I was hoping you'd ask Dr. Blumberg that.
Oh, Dr.
I could give it a stab. I have my, this is personal opinion, which
sure.
Is, I think, you know, in this In our economy and the structure of the economy, these are profit-making enterprises. They need to price their products in order to allow them to continue their work, but that doesn't excuse them from certain social responsibilities. And to Merck's credit, I think they are working to provide vaccines at lower costs in many settings around the developing world. I think there's always the potential to do more, and there are other entities who are trying to make lower-cost vaccines. And one of them is called PATH. So I think we need to work with companies like Merck to provide some pressure to encourage them to continue to do this, because I think that kind of approach worked very well to get the antiretrovirals in. It was only through the very determined efforts of the AIDS activist communities and their allies that the companies that made these drugs were really encouraged to provide those drugs much more cheaply.
Dr. Blumberg, did you want to respond?
Yeah, I would just like to say that this is it's a really complex problem. We are a capitalist society, and so these private manufacturers do want to make profits. But there are several vaccine-preventable diseases which are much more common in developing countries that just don't have the resources for the vaccines, and the vaccines would arguably be even more effective in these countries. So it's not just HPV vaccine, it's meningococcal vaccine, HIV vaccine. Some countries don't have hepatitis B vaccine because they can't afford it. And this is something that I think really needs to be addressed on a worldwide scale. One of the ways that companies say that they can provide the vaccines to less developed countries is because they charge high prices in this country, and basically we could subsidize it to other countries. Well, that just doesn't seem like a very smart system to have. Not that I'm complaining that I can't afford it, but it just doesn't seem like a very smart system to do it that way. So there are other ways to get around this, and people are working on this with other vaccines to try to develop new technologies so that these countries can then make their own vaccine in-country, and that would be important to give access to the vaccine for that country. Plus, it's an economic stimulus for the country. It provides industry. So there's several other vaccines that are being worked at that way.
Do we know, for instance, how much Britain's National Health Service pays for a vaccine? For HPV vaccine, for the Gardasil?
No.
I actually just recently saw an article. It was a physician who was complaining because I think that their contract has been with the Cervarix, which covers two of the strains, and you can pay out of pocket for getting the Gardasil, which covers the four, which he thought was the more sensible way to go, and he was complaining how expensive it was. And I want to say it was also in the hundreds of dollars, but I don't know. Here in the United States, Merck has a contract for a lower price for the Vaccines for Children program, so that it is, I think it's $105 versus $130 for private. So it's slightly lower, but clearly we're not anywhere near the range that someone in a developing country. I mean, in a lot of those countries, they don't even spend nearly that much for all the health care in a year.
No, it has to be down to about $1 a dose.
$1 a dose to make it.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Another question, a different tact here. Is there a risk for developing cancer-causing resistant HPV strains with the widespread use of the vaccine?
That's a really good question, and another way of articulating that is what we call the replacement hypothesis. The idea is you have a certain environment in which 16 and 18 are prevalent. You remove those from the environment by virtue of vaccination. Then the question is, are the remaining HPV types going to change their behavior, perhaps become more aggressive? The good news is that so far there isn't any evidence to suggest that that's going to happen. And, in fact, there is evidence to suggest that we might even reduce the existing risks for those types, even though the vaccine is targeted to 16 and 18, and that's because there's an increasing appreciation that there is some cross-reactivity. So when you get the vaccine targeted to 16 and 18, you're lower risk for some of the other bad players that remain, like types 31 and types 45. So although that is a theoretical concern, so far that does not seem to be playing out.
And before we go on to the next question, let me just do a reminder for our radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking about the impact of the new vaccine Gardasil and what the future holds for the prevention and treatment of HPV. Our panelists are Dr. Joel Pilevsky, UCSF Infectious Disease Specialist, Dr. Dean Blumberg, Associate Director, Pediatric Infectious Disease, UC Davis Medical Center, and an unpaid speaker for Merck and the maker of Gardasil, and Dr. Alina Selanikoff, Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm Sarah Varney. Next question is, since so many sexually active people are carriers of HPV, do you believe that those who know they have it have an ethical obligation to disclose it to their partners? Dr. Blumberg or Alina? Who has to take that?
Most people don't know they have it. Right, that's the thing. It's, you know, it has no symptoms, and, you know, I mean, most people don't know. So, I mean, if you know it, I guess you do have an ethical responsibility to tell someone, but, I mean, it depends on, I mean, most people don't know.
That's one of the things that make it so easy to transmit is that most people who get infected with HPV, they won't have a genital wart. They won't. It's not like herpes where you will see vesicles or something like that. They'll be asymptomatic, and then they feel fine, and so they do their normal activity, including sexual activity. And then their partner, you can't tell just by looking that they're a carrier, like you could, for example, with herpes or sometimes with gonorrhea or something. So there's nothing that would be a turnoff that they would say, whoa, I shouldn't have sexual relations with this person. And that's what makes it so easy, one of the reasons it makes it easy to transmit.
So if you go in just to get a standard STD test, standard battery of STD tests, will this be on that test?
There's really no such thing as a standard battery of STD tests. Typically, people go and get tested if they feel they're at risk. And they will get tested for others like gonorrhea, chlamydia, or syphilis. But there's actually a recommendation specifically against testing young people, and by that I'm defining that at the moment as under the age of 30, against HPV. The reason being that so many of those are going to resolve spontaneously. Mm-hmm. So there's no real clinical value to testing, telling somebody they have an HPV type when there's no real action to be taken because there's no disease.
Next question is, why isn't this vaccine recommended for adults? Is 26 an arbitrary choice? Dr. Blumberg, do you want to take that?
Well, it's FDA licensed between 9 and 26 years of age based on the studies that were done pre-licensure. And so that's how, when we license vaccines in this country, you need to make sure that it's safe and that it works in the population that you're giving it. And so that was the initial studies that were done. The studies on older women, older than 26, have been done also, but that occurred after the vaccine has been licensed. And so that data has also been reviewed by the FDA. But clearly there could be some benefit to women who are older than age 26, less of a benefit than for those who haven't initiated sexual activity, but some benefit.
Well, also because it is so common, HPV, the belief is that a lot of those women have already been exposed, not necessarily to all of the strains, but clearly to one or to two of the strains. And so the cost, this is where you really get into the cost benefit. The cost, is the cost worth it of this vaccine for this group of women who may have already been exposed? And the studies that have looked at it have said basically, no, it's not.
And why not add this to just the regular infant immunization schedule? Hepatitis B, similarly, you don't really get, it's oftentimes sexual contact or other forms as well, but it's similar to HPV. So I wonder, why isn't this just get added to the sort of infant list and therefore you sort of get away from the whole, you know, young girls engaged in sexual activity problem?
Well, I think that hepatitis B is a good example because when the recommendations were made for universal infant immunization with hepatitis B for those infants who were born to mothers who aren't carriers, so didn't have a particular risk from being infected from their mothers, I think we had the wrong approach back then. And what we did was we tied it into saying that when the kid is older, that they can get hepatitis B. It's transmitted by IV drug use or high-risk sexual activity. And you're talking to a parent who's holding their newborn baby and talking to them about this. They don't want to hear that. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That's not the only reason to give it in infancy. The reason to give hepatitis B vaccine then is the bad outcomes from hepatitis B infection are related to chronic carriage of the virus, not acute infection. And the risk of chronic infection with hepatitis B is much higher if one is infected in the newborn period or 6-month-old versus as an adult. So the risk of chronic infection with hepatitis B is 90% if one is infected at birth. It's 5-7% if adolescents or adults get it. So the preventing the bad outcomes is better if you vaccinate early. And the other thing with hepatitis B is it is transmitted in ways that we're not We just don't know exactly how it's transmitted. It is transmitted by IV drug use. It is transmitted, for example, in healthcare workers if they stick themselves with a contaminated needle. It is transmitted by high-risk sexual activity. But even after intensive investigation, about 40% of people who have acute hepatitis B don't fall into one of these risk categories. Now, with HPV, there's some transmission before onset of sexual activity, but the main thing that we're trying to prevent, which is the precursors to cervical cancer and cervical cancer itself, there's no real advantage to giving it in the birth period. It makes more advantage to give that just prior to onset of sexual activity or when kids, you may think they might start having sexual activity. So it fits into the schedule better in adolescence. And now we have this adolescent platform of vaccination with other vaccines that we're giving at that time. So to me, it makes more sense to give it then and not give it in infancy. And plus, obviously it hasn't been studied as given in an infant vaccine.
Dr.
Yeah, the other point is that we still don't know how long the immune response is going to last. So the longer you give it away from the time that women are at highest risk, which would presumably be once they reach their mid-teens and on, I think the likelier it is that you may lose some of that protection.
How long at this point do they estimate that it protects you for?
Well, I think the thought was originally that we'd be lucky if we got protection for about 10 years. And at this point, we've been following women for as long as 7, and they still seem to be protected. And for a variety of theoretical reasons and some challenge study results, we're actually more and more confident that that protection may be even more long-lasting.
Another question from our audience. Isn't promoting condom use just cheaper than encouraging vaccination?
I'll take that one.
Yeah.
Of course, condom use is always to be encouraged because it does a lot of good things, prevents other sexually transmitted infections. It's great to prevent HIV. In the case of HPV, unfortunately, it's helpful, but it's not the sole answer. Couples that report using condoms 100% of the time, studies of those couples have actually shown that you can reduce HPV transmission by about 70%. So under the very best scenario, we might get about a 30% reduction. There are too many ways that HPV can get from skin to skin, even if you're wearing condoms. And so, unfortunately, condoms alone are not the answer.
Hmm. And I think we touched on this a little bit, but it's an interesting question. Are we seeing drops in cervical cancer rates yet? And if not, when do we expect to see the results of the vaccine?
I would expect many, many years down the line, because if we're vaccinating adolescents in cervical cancer, the average age in this country of cervical cancer diagnosis is about 49. So really, if you start vaccinating teenagers today, you're going to have to wait decades to really see that kind of an impact. You'll probably see impact earlier on CIN, the cervical intraepithelial neoplasia types 2 and 3. You'll see that in a few years.
Right. In fact, a study was reported at the last international papillomavirus meeting in Australia from an STD clinic in Melbourne, where they've shown a quite dramatic drop in the incidence of warts in women who've been vaccinated against HPV with Gardasil.
I bet the local restaurants that are serving that conference probably thought that was pretty interesting to hear that. Alina, I wonder if you could take this question. If the vaccine is mandated, will the increase in the demand decrease the price? Sounds like a logical question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a big if it's mandated. You would think that would work that way, but I don't know that necessarily. I think what may work to reduce the price is competition. Right now, we only have one vaccine that's been approved, and the way I think that the competitor, which I think is very close to getting approved, I think that the committee actually recommended to the FDA that it was safe and effective, and so now it's a matter of going through kind of the final process and having that decision made. Will that be significantly lower than the Gardasil? And then you're going to have, I mean, if you have competition. But one of the things is, the vaccine manufacturing market is very small. There are actually very few pharmaceutical companies that manufacture vaccines. So when you have kind of that diminished competition, the prices don't go down that quickly.
And a couple questions here about some of the pushback against the vaccine. I wonder if some of you can address some of the arguments that are responsible for the pushback against the vaccine, and whether or not some of these questions around the long-term implications of the vaccine have any merit. Dr. Pulaski, do you want to take that?
Well, there's a lot of different issues that have been brought up. And some of them, I think, are very legitimate issues, and some of them, I think, are a little bit less compelling. Safety is obviously paramount. We've all taken a Hippocratic oath to, above all, do no harm. And as any new product is introduced, I think there's always a risk because we just don't know. We haven't seen how it behaves in many millions of people over a very long period of time. That said, with the system that Dr. Blumberg described, there still is no evidence to suggest that we have a significant signal for new, unanticipated, serious adverse events safety-wise. Some of the other issues that some of my other panelists might want to address are around whether that might change sexual behavior. Perhaps Dr. Sliganikov can discuss that one. One that is a serious concern is that, also as we alluded to before, that if women are being vaccinated, they might think that they're protected against other HPV types, and so they do need to be well-educated to make sure they're continuing to get their pap smears, and also that we need to make it clear that they're not protected against other sexually transmitted infections, and they need to get their primary care. There are other biological issues that have been raised, such as the replacement hypothesis one. Again, so far, knock wood, we don't have any evidence to suggest that there are any unanticipated concerns. Do we need to be vigilant? Of course we do, because signals can still show up later. They can show up when you've vaccinated many more millions of women. But what we always have to ask ourselves is, what is the cost and benefit? And in my personal opinion, when you look at what the vaccine could do and what the potential risks are as they're emerging, to me it seems pretty clear that there's more benefit than harm.
Dr. Slanikoff, I wonder if you can address this issue of some of the reasons why some parents at least, don't want to vaccinate their children with this vaccine.
Well, I mean, the issue about, you know, whether it would encourage sexual behavior, there is absolutely no evidence at all that having a vaccination will encourage, you know, risky sexual behavior among teens. Absolutely none. And, you know, there's lots of other problems that this vaccination doesn't cover ever. In that case, I mean, I think that there is concern. I think there's general concern around vaccine safety. And, you know, clearly this has been a very highly polarized issue and where people feel very passionately on both ends. And I think that this area, I think that even people who believe very strongly in vaccination, I think that this has, you know, in some people has planted seeds of doubt. And so I think that's an area where I think that you might have.
To what extent, though, do you think that's influenced by the fact that this was recommended just for girls? That somehow we as parents think that
our girls pre-sexual girls and not boys. Absolutely. Boys. I mean, I think that that was a strong. I mean, I think there was a couple of issues. One is that it was recommended for a population clearly pre-sexual girls, 11 to 12, a very difficult age for parents to manage to begin with. And then there was a very strong push for mandates. So you had this, you know, you had a new vaccine to a group that we consider vulnerable, so to speak, and with a very strong push to require this. And I think there was a tremendous backlash in that regard.
And Dr. Blumberg, do you think that push was coming from just concerned physicians who saw that this is a good thing for girls to do? Or do you think that was really Merck, really trying to get the return on their investment?
I can't,
or a little bit of both.
Yeah, I really can't speak for Merck, but it's been well documented that they did donate money and lobby states' legislatures to mandate the vaccine. And I saw that in California, and I work with our immunization coalitions, and I know locally it was not the right time to do that, and I anticipated pushback, and I told them so. And, you know, unfortunately, not everybody listens to me.
But there was, they actually had a marketing campaign for Gardasil before it was FDA approved. And it was a pretty, pretty large and effective campaign that focused on television, magazines. And so that, you know, they kind of were laying the groundwork for this big push. And I think that not only in California, but in a lot of other state legislatures, they were very, very present in terms of their lobbying efforts to state legislators, and that there was a real backlash as a result of that.
Now, the dust has settled a bit, which I'm glad about, but you know, there is this still lingering question about this whole sexuality and HPV vaccine. And when I talk to parents, I just tell them, if they want to talk about sex, then they can talk about sex. But what I want to talk about is preventing cancer. And so I just ask them the question, do you want your daughter to get the anti-cancer vaccine or not? That's the question I ask parents to think about. And if they want to talk about and think about sex too, they can do that. But I don't think you have to necessarily connect those issues.
And do you think if, say, we've been talking a bit about the hepatitis B vaccine, do you think if the hepatitis B vaccine were introduced in a certain way, again, for pre-adolescent girls and boys, that we would have gotten a similar discussion about this is inappropriate for this age group?
Absolutely, and I think we did get that discussion when it was recommended for universal infant immunization in 1991, because at that time, pediatricians and others, family practitioners, were making that connection, and that was the wrong connection to make. The connection to make is we want to prevent cancer. We want to prevent hepatocellular cancer. And so it took years to recover from that, but now we have very high vaccination rates against hepatitis B, and we've seen the rates of acute hepatitis B in this country fall way down, and one would expect that cirrhosis and hepatocellular carcinoma in the future will be able to document that that is reduced also. So I think that was a mistake from the beginning, and it took years for that effort to recover from that, but we have recovered from that.
And just one final question, because I just have a couple more minutes here. For Dr. Pileski, once the HPV develops into cancerous cells, the listener wants to know, is it treatable? Is the treatment successful?
The treatments for cervical cancer are successful depending on how early it's caught. So if it's caught very early, the treatment is mostly successful. If it's caught in an advanced stage, then it's usually fatal.
Okay, actually, we do have a few more minutes, and I'm going by that clock. Let's see. A question here from a listener who wants to know, what is the medical community doing to outreach and educate about HPV? So I guess maybe to a certain extent, what are family physicians or pediatricians being told about HPV? And although maybe they're pulling back, Merck is pulling back from this very aggressive public campaign, what are physicians being told about their responsibility, in a sense, for educating parents about this vaccine? Dr. Blumberg, do you want to
I can tell you that I've worked with the California Medical Association Foundation and their HPV prevention project, and they're trying to get tools in providers' hands so that they're able to talk with parents and with kids more about this, talking about some of the common issues that we brought up today, some of the difficult questions that people will ask, and give them some potential responses to those challenges. And have campaigns to make sure. The last campaign that was vaccinate your daughter, test yourself, to try to tie in with mothers to make sure that mothers continue getting pap smears and to get the daughter vaccinated to prevent things in the future.
I think the other challenge here is that this vaccine, not just with the 11 to 12-year-olds, but with the older group, is you have OBGYNs involved in this, which is not a group that has traditionally done vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And so there are, I think, there are challenges there that are very different, I think, than working with group pediatricians who are more comfortable, at least in discussing some of the vaccine safety issues involved. And so
how is that working then? Are the OB gynecologists doing the vaccinations themselves in the offices, having to be trained how to do them?
Some of them are, yes.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a really interesting issue, because many women get their primary care from their obstetrician gynecologist, and that's who they see on a routine basis. Mm-hmm. And now we've got other vaccines that they should get. So not just HPV, but obviously during pregnancy, we've been recommending influenza vaccine for years, because women who are pregnant and get influenza have bad outcomes not only for themselves, but can have bad outcomes for the pregnancy. And obstetricians have not been a group that have been high vaccine users, mm-hmm. and there's a real challenges to to making things run smoothly in a practice with vaccines. So it is a challenge. I think it's also an opportunity. We're also recommending now the TDAP vaccine for mothers to make sure that they're protected against pertussis or whooping cough, because their infants are very vulnerable to bad outcomes for that. So I think that we've got a real good opportunity now to get OB-GYN more involved with vaccination programs.
So how would you imagine that rolling out? I mean, particularly since we're now talking a lot about this concept of a medical home, your primary care physician coordinating all of your care. Would you see in sort of the ideal environment that the obstetricians and gynecologists would actually do the vaccines, or that they would just say, a reminder, this needs to be done, you need to go back to your medical home, your primary care doc, and get this done?
Well, hopefully they would do the vaccines, because if you tell somebody you should get this done, they may or may not get it done. And so if you've got a bird in the hand, just, take it right then. And so that's where, at the point where they're being seen, you don't want to miss that opportunity to vaccinate.
I mean, hopefully we'll get to a point where we have information systems,
right, sure.
So that it will be in a patient's record when they go to see their primary care doc or their OBGYN or any other specialist, that they will know what are the vaccines that they have received. Right now, our system is extremely fragmented and ineffective in that way.
And the state immunization branch, as well as our state immunization coalitions, are working to facilitate the development of statewide vaccine information systems so that all medical offices and schools have access to those vaccine records, and also working with the OB-GYN community to try to facilitate vaccination in that community.
And we were talking about pregnant women. What if you're a pregnant woman and you're under 26, you're in that catch-up group? Should you be getting that vaccine while you're pregnant, or should you wait? Can you pass it on to your child, to the birth canal? Or?
Well, we're always very concerned about administering anything during pregnancy, and so the vaccine has not been studied in pregnancy, and it's not recommended in pregnancy, just because we're always afraid that something could alter the pregnancy in that way. And so it's recommended just to wait till after the pregnancy to get vaccinated.
Some people actually believe that women who are in the middle of vaccination, who are at risk of getting pregnant, should take very effective contraceptive measures. Mm-hmm.
And is there that risk, though, to passing it on to the child?
There's always the risk of passing on HPV to the child, but it's rare. And again, the situation where that's most clinically apparent is with these respiratory warts, and it's not common enough that one would automatically worry about that.
And a question here actually about pap smears. The listener asked, why are pap smears only an annual occurrence? If this is such a prevalent virus, shouldn't we get them even more often? I hope not. But
I'll take that one. I mean, as Dr. Blumberg said, the natural history of the disease is rather slow, so it can take many decades to go from a cancer precursor to invasive cancer. So you don't really need to, fortunately, sample that often to catch it in time.
And another listener asked, other than age, are there any other factors that can disqualify someone from getting the vaccine? I.e., I can't quite read what they say, but perhaps if you're gay, or I'm not sure what else, it's something J partners. I don't know what that means, but.
Well, it's not recommended during pregnancy. It's only recommended right now 9 to 26 years of age as licensed, and only females. And then obviously if somebody's had an allergic or severe reaction to one dose of the vaccine, they shouldn't get the vaccine.
Yeast, I believe, yeah.
And it's grown in a yeast cell system, so there's a very small amount of yeast in the vaccine, similar to hepatitis B vaccine. So if they have an anaphylactic, a shock-like reaction to yeast, then they shouldn't get the vaccine.
But I, on the subject of being gay, I think it's quite the opposite as far as whether somebody should get the vaccine, because studies by our group and many others have shown that men who have sex with men are at very high risk of getting anal HPV infection and anal cancer. And in my mind, this is one of the great potential indications for the male vaccine, because although even if you vaccinated all women and you might prevent prevention of transmission to men, but if you're talking about male-to-male transmission, that won't help. So I think the most direct way would be to vaccinate people at high risk. And here we have a bit of a problem, because we don't know necessarily if somebody's at high risk by virtue of being attracted to men in time in many situations. So that's one of the arguments for doing universal vaccination in boys, to cover not only the complications that occur in heterosexual men, but also in MSM.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so that's the end of our program. I'd like to thank our panelists, Dr. Joel Pilewski from UCSF, infectious disease specialist, Dr. Dean Blumberg, he's the associate director of pediatric infectious disease, UC Davis Medical Center, and an unpaid speaker for Merck, the maker of Gardasil, and Dr. Alina Selenikov, vice president and director of women's health policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation. We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. This program has been underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. I'm Sarah Varney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.